Greetings to the brightest audience in the country. Welcome to another episode of Real Science Friday. I'm Bob Enyart.
And I'm Fred Williams, creation speaker and software engineer.
Last week, we were interviewing Walter Remine, author of The Biotic Message. Fred, what did you think of our interview with Walter Remine last week?
Oh, I thought it was great, especially the evolving body parts, jawbones that these scientists are using, and yet some of them are hypothetical and they don't tell the audience that.
That was such a great point, and the fish fins evolving into teeth. Yeah, Walter makes so many great points.
Kind of brings back memories. I kind of viewed myself as Remine's bulldog back when he first introduced a lot of these arguments on the internet, because it generated a lot of interest.
And on your forum, evolutionfairytale.com, your forum is one of the best out there for debating these topics. And you guys really went to battle presenting and defending Walter Remine's argument.
The arguments are so powerful. That's why it drew a lot of attention from the evolutionists, and their illusions were being exposed. Mm-hmm. You know, as Walter points out in his book, being a magician is kind of a hobby. It's useful for him to know how illusions work, and they are powerful. It's amazing how many people fall for these, but it's also easy to see behind them when you talk through them. The illusions are very clear.
Like we talked about body parts evolving into body parts. That's an illusion. Supra-specific groups evolving into groups. That's an illusion. Organisms reproduce. Species reproduce, not body parts.
Yeah, and in the last interview, Walter pointed out how evolutionists have kind of gone away from some of these arguments, but you still see them, and they promote the illusion that there's ancestors when they don't exist.
All right, so electrical engineer Walter Remine, author of The Biotic Message. Do we have Walter back on with us?
Yes, I'm right here.
All right, Walter Remine, welcome back to Real Science Friday.
Thanks for having me.
Well, we loved it. The comments, a lot of thumbs up on your work. And so now, could we talk about naive natural selection? I learned so much in this chapter 5 of your book, and maybe we could begin with the section on uphill evolution so the audience could catch up to what we're going to talk about when we get to naive natural selection. What is the general concept of uphill evolution?
Well, evolutionists were purveying the idea that natural selection is inevitable. It's an inevitable process that takes of species of low fitness and creates higher fitness and higher complexity, evolution upward, upward, upward forever. And they made it seem that this process is inevitable and undeniable, that it will happen, and that you'd be a fool to deny it. I call that process, that idea that they're selling, naive natural selection.
Naive, because it turns out that there is so much complexity that they add to that, that indeed the true evolutionists, who are the leaders who are publishing, say, you know what, it's not really all uphill. It's sideways, it's downhill, it's down the valley, up that hill.
Yes.
And so we'll get into all that. But then you point out the naive version. It's sort of like an army marching up a hill.
Yes.
And the thought is every soldier is taking steps to get up the hill. And as they get up the hill, then when they get to the top, they're stronger. They're more well adapted. So that's the picture, evolution ever uphill. But you point out, you use a metaphor. You say, well, as the soldiers are marching up the hill, marbles are rolling down toward them. And so they're sort of slipping. So at the end of the day, whether or not they're a little further up the hill than not is a matter of historical fact. And John Sanford, who's one of the world's leading experts on genetics, I think he wrote a book, Walter, on the marbles. It's 20 years later, he came out with a book on entropy and what's going wrong with genetics.
Yeah, with all the harmful mutations. And I believe he quotes Walter Remine several times in his book. He uses the princess and the pea analogy, that you have all these harmful mutations and it creates so much noise that natural selection can't select individual little changes in the genome. It has to select an individual.
there's one benefit somewhere in your 3 billion base pairs of amino acids.
Yeah.
There's one neutral or positive mutation, one positive one. There's 100 or thousands of negative ones.
Yeah.
How's evolution? And he got this argument from you, Walter. I'm absolutely certain of it after reading your book.
Yeah. How can evolution select that individual supposed beneficial change? Mm-hmm. It can't. It has to select an individual that has all the baggage that comes with it. And all those harmful mutations are being ignored. And they create a huge amount of what we could call noise. You can't see through the noise to even detect this small beneficial change. All these other things that aren't beneficial. So that somewhat plays into this analogy of these marbles rolling downhill and you're slipping on them and how you actually making it uphill.
Just in February 2012, John Sanford, Cornell professor emeritus, he's a co-inventor of the gene gun, brilliant guy. So he's speaking to a group of young earth creationists and he says, you know what? All the mutations, even if the survival of the fittest, even if only the fittest survive every generation, he says, we are marching backward, not uphill, but we're marching downhill. And he gave an example. If half of this audience dies out, and the whole audience sort of shuddered, if half died out and they were all the least fit, and so the most fit, then they had kids, and half of them died out, and it was always the least fit dying, well, so what? The most fit have more genetic mutations than their ancestors. And so the most fit are not getting better, they're getting worse, and that's a serious problem for Darwinism.
Very serious. Yeah, I call this problem error catastrophe. It's also known as mutational meltdown. Mm. It's where a population receives mutations faster than it can get rid of them. And so no matter how you select, no matter how fearsome and fearful the selection process takes place, the population evolves downhill. It gets more and more deteriorated genetically.
Mm.
That process can be demonstrated really on any computer simulation of evolution. You just turn up the mutation rate or turn down the reproduction rate, and eventually you will see error catastrophe taking place.
Well, you contributed to a project, I believe, with some leading scientists on that, right? The Mendel's accountant?
Yes. Yes. Yeah. A group of creation researchers, of which I'm a part, constructed really the best computer simulation in the world. It's a forward time population genetics simulation of evolution.
And you can get this online, right?
Yes, it's freely available to anyone to use. And you plug into that simulation any realistic values you care to use and watch the error catastrophe happen on your own computer.
I just thought of an analogy for error catastrophe.
Yeah.
This is kind of like Greece, right?
Greece.
You know, like they're the movie? Like our... No, the country, like our national debt, right?
Yeah.
It's kind of an illusion when politicians say that I'm cutting spending.
Oh.
When they're, all they're doing is slowing the growth of their spending.
Yeah.
You're still spending more money than you're taking in, and eventually you're going to go broke. So like
and
Greece, we're in error
yourself.
Catastrophe with our debt.
Right. So we're lying to ourselves saying we're cutting spending because we're still spending more than we did last
year. That's right. It's an illusion.
So to say that, well, look at these beneficial mutations – when really it's all the harmful mutations that are making the impact.
That's right.
And you can watch this error catastrophe take place on your own computer. It's a fascinating problem to watch, and evolutionists are avoiding it.
And I imagine, Walter Remine, you guys called it Mendel's accountant because Gregor Mendel, the father of genetics, was a creationist, as were so many of the fathers of the physical sciences, from Copernicus and Isaac Newton and Kepler and Mendel, and we could name dozens of the giants in the physical sciences.
Louis Pasteur.
So, Walter Remine, how about this concept of the fitness terrain? When I first read it, I thought, well, Walter's come up with a new idea here, but it turns out the world's leading evolutionists have come up with the fitness terrain. And it's part of the complexity that Darwinism is today. What is the fitness terrain? And for the audience, we're not all technical. What in the world are evolutionists talking about when it's not just marching up a hill and becoming more well adapted?
Okay. The idea of the fitness terrain or fitness landscape is not original with me. Evolutionists have talked about that idea for a long time in their academic books. Hmm. They don't talk about it so much in their public presentations because it causes them problems. Let me talk first about what evolutionists sell to the public. The idea that they sell to the public is that evolution is up a fitness incline, up, 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 ever upwards. And if this little population of soldiers, as we call them, can take one teeny tiny step up the hill, then that's enough to explain all of evolution.
And that's, in fact, Richard Dawkins' book, Climbing Mount Improbable.
Yes.
You have this mountain, and it's constantly an improvement through mutations and natural selection. Everything is getting better. It's becoming more well-adapted. It's becoming more fit.
Yes. So in naive natural selection, there's two false ideas. One is that air catastrophe is impossible, doesn't occur, so they avoid it altogether. Hmm. They ignore it, like it doesn't happen. It's not an issue. The other falsehood about naive natural selection is the idea that the fitness terrain is an incline, upwards, ever upwards. In actual fact, the fitness terrain has shape. It has hills and valleys and mountains and crevasses, and that shape of the fitness terrain creates obstacles to evolution. And they've known this. Evolutionists, academic evolutionists, have known this for a very long time.
Well, you quote an American geneticist. In fact, he's a Royal Society Fellow here in the U.S. He won the National Medal of Science, Sewell Wright. And Sewell Wright described this fitness terrain. And so this is a new idea to me. I'm trying to process, what does it mean? And I thought of an example. We on this show talk about the difficulty, Fred Williams and I, of evolving wings out of legs. And we like to say that you'd get bad legs long before you got good wings.
Yeah.
So if a fitness terrain has a hill, and so some species is evolving up the hill, and it's a species that didn't have legs to start with. And so by becoming more and more well adapted to the terrain, they're evolving legs. And eventually they have these great legs and they're at the top of the hill. So the whole army marched to the top and they started, they had no legs. By the time they're done, 100 million years later, they have legs. Well, great. Because they have legs, now how are they going to get wings? They have to start going down the hill.
Yes.
And across a valley and over some bumps and through a ditch and now start going up a different hill that's the hill for wings.
Yes.
And that's quite the problem. So it's not just ever uphill evolution.
Well, it could work if it wasn't for that ditch.
That's right. It's not just ever uphill evolution. Actually, that uphill evolution is quite a barrier to Darwinism. And so they have to come up with ways to go downhill and to get the whole species to go downhill for a long, long time and go all over the fitness landscape, the terrain. And you pointed out that evolution is not really a theory that you can test. It's more like a fog that settles on the landscape. And no matter how twisted the data is, the theory always fits it.
Yes. I describe evolutionary theory as like fog adapting to landscape. Hmm. Throw data at it and evolutionary theory just morphs around it. It's an untestable theory as it's practiced today. It's macroevolutionary theory is structureless. It predicts nothing. Natural selection theory doesn't predict that higher life forms are even possible.
Hmm.
Natural selection theory does not predict that molecules or bacteria to man evolution is even possible. It makes no such prediction. Evolutionists claim it happens, but their theory does not predict that it's even possible. Okay, what we know today is that fitness terrain offers obstacles to evolution. It can keep evolution from happening. A population gets stuck at the top of some local fitness peak, and it's prevented from evolving. And we know that from the theory. That's possible. The theory says it, but it doesn't say large-scale evolution is possible. That's not what the theory says. And so we creationists can embrace everything about all the assumptions about natural selection theory and still say with complete self-consistency that evolution can't happen.
Yeah, we mentioned this in the last show, but you support all of this with, you just quote evolutionists in your book, right? And there's all kinds of references to evolutionists.
Hundreds of quotes to evolutionists.
Oh, yeah, hundreds. And I like this one from this Dr. Hartle. He's a population geneticist, and he noted that any population on a fitness peak is destined to stay there because natural selection will not carry the population down into any of the surrounding valleys and ditches, according to Bob, and thus perhaps into the domain of attraction of a higher fitness peak. The population is simply stuck.
So, Walter, remind, this is where the lights were turning on for me, that I really, after all these years, had just understood the naive natural selection. I had not realized all this complexity. So here is the author of The Principles of Population Genetics, and he is explaining exactly what you brought to light, that, well, if natural selection happens to the species and they're on the top of the hill, then they're stuck. They can't get anywhere. And this is quite a problem. So they have invented many, many techniques with tremendous complexity and contradictory techniques to get the species to go down the hill and through the valley and up the other hill and all that.
Yes. And it's their theory, as they practice it, it's an unscientific mess. You can't test it. It's structureless. It makes no predictions that macroevolution will occur. It's a structureless mess.
It doesn't deserve the status of theory.
Yeah, it's not science. The theory that they promote is not science according to their own criteria that they use in court.
So now that we've just explained all this, could we go back and tell us again, and I think the audience will grasp it better, I think I will, tell us again then, what is naive natural selection?
Okay. Naive natural selection is the evolutionist idea that they present to the public. They know it's false, but they present it quite often to the public. The idea that evolution is uphill, uphill, it's unstoppable, no one can doubt it, it will happen anywhere that there's life, and so forth. It's inevitable, they say.
And Richard Dawkins' book, Climbing Mount Improbable, is just another recent example of exactly that misrepresentation to the public.
Yes. And they're ignoring two completely separate problems, contradictions to their point of view. One is error catastrophe and mutational meltdown. The other problem is that the fitness terrain has shape that forms obstacles to evolution. Both of those points contradict their naive natural selection theory that they sell to the public.
And the first one is inevitable, the error catastrophe. They can't avoid it.
Mm-hmm. Yeah. Walter, remind, did you coin the term naive natural selection?
I did.
Yeah, that is such a great term. In the section where you define naive natural selection, you mention Richard Dawkins, although that was before he wrote his book, Climbing Mount Improbable. You mentioned his book, The Blind Watchmaker. I made a comment back in the 1990s, Walter, that Richard Dawkins, I had a caller call in and say, Bob, you got to read Dawkins because, you know, he presents the argument for evolution. And I said to the caller, and we have this on video, and it's up on YouTube, in about a 3-minute YouTube video. I said, if you read any of Richard Dawkins' books, you will find out that he is not laying out evidence proving evolution. He's merely giving us analogies, and he thinks by presenting an analogy, he's proving his case.
Yes.
And so what's amazing is 2 years ago, he came out with a promotion for his newest book, and he said this. He said, in all of my previous books, I did not provide evidence for evolution. I merely assumed evolution was true. Now he's going to try to provide evidence.
Oh, my God.
So he corroborated this claim contrary to what every atheist and evolutionist in the world would have said back in the 1990s. Not one would have agreed with this creationist characterization that Dawkins is not giving evidence for evolution. Not one, but then he confirmed it.
Yeah, amazing. Yeah, there's been a new development concerning natural selection, new in the past 10, 15 years, 20 years. It's quite fascinating. A lot of evolutionists now are acknowledging that natural selection is not sufficient. it's not sufficient. It's just the opposite of what they've had in the national science education standards. It's the opposite of what they've been teaching in school. They've been teaching in school that natural selection is sufficient. Mm. Now evolutionists are saying, no, it's not sufficient. They're acknowledging that. And I'll point to a good example of that. It's a book written by an evolutionist about other evolutionists. It's called the Altenburg 16. And the idea is this group of 16 leading evolutionists got together in a, more or less, they tried to keep it in a secret meeting. They got together in Altenburg. It's in Europe to discuss the insufficiency of natural selection, which they agree it's insufficient, and what might replace it. Now, let me give you an idea of why they're driven to this position. New evidence has come out about the genetic toolbox that occurs in more or less all life forms at the genetic level, and it's this genetic toolbox, you may have heard it called the homeobox or various names, but it's a common set of genes that control development of the embryo, and development of the organism.
Mm-hmm.
Okay, and they found this common set of genes, more or less in all organisms, and it's so widely distributed in life that it had to have been, according to evolutionary theory, it had to have been present prior to the diversification of those life forms.
Yeah.
In other words, this toolbox of genes had to have been present in the Precambrian before the diversification of all life forms.
Yeah.
So what was that life form? Well, the life forms generally back then were bacteria, single-celled organisms, organisms without an embryo and without a body. So there's the dilemma right there. That's the dilemma they're struggling with, is that the genes that control embryos' development and the formation of different body types, those genes had to have originated when there were no embryos and there were no bodies.
Wow.
Okay? That's quite a yeah. contradiction.
Yeah.
And so evolutionists wow. are saying, quite correctly, that, gee, natural selection could not have done this because natural selection cannot look ahead
right.
to some future purpose. It can only select for what helps right now.
Right.
It'll be curious
so
to hear what
they
story.
They are positing that some other mechanism other than natural selection must have created this genetic toolbox.
What do they come up with? Have they,
well, they're
aliens?
Well, yeah, they're struggling in lots of different directions.
Well,
one of the ideas is self-organization, that just there's something about molecules that self-organizes them.
Well, some of the world's leading science theorists have been addressing that recently, and they have been attempting to quantify the ability of matter to self-organize, and they're showing that there are severe limits to the properties of atoms. Severe limits, and that self-organization is not going to develop complex information content, because what it does is it gives you the same repeating patterns over and over, self-organizing
yeah.
matter, like
yeah.
crystals or snowflakes. And so what you find is a few general principles that repeat over quadrillions of times. But life, the DNA, the genetic information in life is the opposite of that. It's not the same patterns repeating over and over. It's very different specified patterns. Walter Remine, Fred mentioned aliens. When DNA, the double helix, was discovered, as recently to Richard Dawkins appearing in Ben Stein's movie Expelled, they talk about aliens. And they say, well, if it turns out that life is so complex that natural selection cannot create life, well, then we know it came from aliens. Aliens must have done it. And we ask, well, where did the aliens come from? If you can't evolve life here, why can you do it around Mars or Alpha Centauri?
So, yeah, they just use the aliens to push the problem back in time and out into space. The problem still exists. Where did the original information come from?
Yeah, evolutionists have tried that before with evolution from space, Fred Hoyle's idea, and Francis Crick, even. Various evolutionists, Leslie Orgel, different people have proposed the idea of panspermia, that life came from outer space.
Right.
The reason they propose those ideas is because the origin of life problem is unsolvable, in their view.
It's unsolvable. There have been no new ideas. There's no real funding, and it's a dead area of research.
Yeah. Creationists own the origin of life issue now.
You know what's interesting, Walter? Thank you for saying that. The atheists accuse us. They say God did not make man. Man made God. Well, the belief in aliens, that's a man-made thing, right?
Yeah.
So they made aliens, and they say aliens made man. So their accusation is directly applicable to what they're doing. They say aliens made us, and it's irrefutable that they concocted the idea of aliens.
Yes. Well, another example of that is the idea of multiverses, or an infinitude of other universes unlike our own. That's their version of the supernatural. They created that idea in order to avoid evidence that looks like the universe is designed or finely tuned for our existence.
And if you try to develop, say, a brand new type of protein or an enzyme that's never appeared before, say something involving being able to react to a single photon for a vision system, and it has hundreds of amino acids in a certain order, and then they're folded in a certain order. Well, if you took the entire universe and every electron was a laboratory trying to create that protein 10,000 times a second, you could do it for a trillion years and you might not get the one protein. And even if you did get it, you'd just have a dead protein. So you could give them trillions upon trillions upon trillions of multi-universes, each of them existing for trillions of years, and they wouldn't come up with the requirements they need for life or the fine-tuned universe and so on.
Well, maybe neutral evolution solves it.
Neutral evolution. Well, that's a topic for another discussion. Walter, we're out of time again. Do you think you could join us for maybe a third show?
Yes.
Wow, what an honor. Fred, did you ever think you'd be able to talk to Walter Remine and have all your questions answered?
Well, I almost had the opportunity. He came out and spoke to our Rocky Mountain Creation Fellowship group about 5 years ago. And unfortunately, I worked really hard to get Walter to come out here. And then I was in a wedding party and I couldn't go to the... I got to briefly meet Walter before I had to go to the rehearsal dinner.
Well, that's great. And Walter, I'm so thankful you're being generous with your time. So if it's all right with you, we'll conclude today's show and we'll do another program.
Thank you for having me.
You're very welcome. So, Fred, it is so fun to talk to Walter Remine. Thank you for strongly recommending that I read The Biotic Message. And I think we have so many resources in the science department on our store that people listening, if they love to hear creationists exposing the illusions from evolutionists, I think they would absolutely love Dr. Carl Werner's series, Evolution, the Grand Experiment, which is the first, and then Living Fossils. Other DVDs that we have that I strongly recommend, Dr. Don Johnson's Programming of Life, which I believe is the best cell biology DVD ever produced, ever made. You got to check it out. We'll list these on our website. When you come to realsciencefriday.com, you could peruse all the different shows we do, the interviews, the debates. The summaries are all there, and then with each show, we recommend a specific science resource, a book, a debate, a DVD, and I just highly recommend Dr. Carl Werner's Living Fossils. I think you'll love it. Hey, we're out of time. Thank you to Walter Remine and Fred Williams. This is Bob Enyart. God bless you.